com.
It's 6 minutes now past 11. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Former State Auditor Mark Dayton surprised a lot of people last spring when, seemingly out of the blue, he announced that he would run for the U.S. Senate this year. After all, just 2 years ago, he finished a distant fourth in the DFL primary for governor and more or less dropped out of sight after that election. Plus, he entered this year's race so late, the other candidates had been running for months, lining up supporters along the way. As a result, some of the so-called experts poo-pooed Mark Dayton's chances last spring. But as we know now, those experts were wrong. Mr. Dayton won last month's Senate primary by a wide margin, and according to the latest polls, is leading incumbent Republican Rod Grams as we approach the general election next month. Today on Midday, we're going to talk with the man who may end up as Minnesota's next U.S. Senator. Mark Dayton has come by our studios today as part of our Meet the Candidates series to talk about the issues and to take your questions. And we do invite you to join our conversation. Give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can call us at 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Our guest this hour, DFL U.S. Senate candidate Mark Dayton. Mr. Dayton, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be here.
Did you think you were going to do this well this past spring when you jumped into the race?
Well, I wouldn't have gone into the race if I didn't believe I could win. I said it was anyone's race to win, as opposed to, as it was in 98, turned out to be, at least through the DFL primary, Skip Humphrey's race to lose. So I was optimistic, or I wouldn't have done it, certainly not for the exercise. But the primary turned out better than I had probably hoped. And, of course, the general election's 29 days away, so the polls, as far as I'm concerned, are meaningless until the final one on November 7th.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did, of course, you were elected state auditor in the statewide race. But prior to that, you had run for the U.S. Senate in 82 and you lost. Then, of course, 2 years ago, ran for governor and lost in the primary. What's different this year? Why has your campaign caught fire this time?
Well, maybe it's in part that persistence pays. I think that the voters actually have a broader view of this maybe than some of the political pundits, because I think they do view term of public service as a sign of commitment, as opposed to being washed up over the hill, or in some ways in the vernacular, if you're qualified for office, you're disqualified because you have prior experience. And also, I think this case, as I said earlier, there was nobody who had the kind of two-generation name standing that Skip Humphrey had. The Humphrey name was just one that was insurmountable for all the rest of us in that primary for governor. I came out of that believing, and I think the polls showed afterward, that we were all popular. It wasn't that people were against myself or any of the others. It's just that they preferred Skip. So I sort of took that lesson to heart and thought, well, in this case, my name's been out and involved in public service longer than anybody else, certainly in the DFL side, and maybe that'll work to my advantage this time. And so far, it seems to have done so.
Now, Rod Grams, in his TV ads specifically, has charged you with being a hypocrite for railing against excessive drug company profits, even while you were personally benefiting from drug company profits as a shareholder in some drug companies. How do you respond to that charge?
Well, it's well known, was lucky enough to be born into a wealthy family, and I inherited stocks and have diversified over time. So my entire political career, which spans now over 25 years, has been speaking out and opposing actions and activities by corporations which probably benefit my own financial interests, but which I think are bad policy for the people of Minnesota and the people of this country. So I think to single that out at this point in time, to my mind is off the point. But I'm not expecting to get Senator Graham's vote in the general election, so I guess he can call me pretty much whatever names he wants to. I think people can assess for themselves whether those charges are accurate or not. I've sold all my stocks now and everything I own. I'll pay a hefty capital gains price to do so, but I'd rather just get beyond this issue and focus on what I think are the really important issues that Minnesotans care about.
Why did you sell all your stock? It does seem like kind of an overreaction to...
that term's been used. I didn't think so. I was being criticized for one and criticized for another. I just thought that it would be better to set the whole issue aside and to proceed accordingly. I'm not into public service for the money. My campaigns cost me a great deal of money. I'm fortunate enough to be able to afford it, but this is a very sizable, huge commitment on my part this year. So I just thought it was a way of making a very clear statement, hopefully to Minnesotans, that my desire to serve is sincere, and whatever people may disagree or about my position on issues, I don't think anybody could fairly say I've ever tried to profit myself either through campaigns or through public service. I work as a state auditor for $1 a year. I said I will do the same as a United States senator, and I want people's decisions as much as possible to be based on their views of me and my positions on the issues compared to Senator Graham's, Mr. Gibson's, and others.
Democrat candidate Mark Dayton is with us, running for the U.S. Senate this fall, and of course he will be in the Democratic column when you look at your ballot on November 7th. He's come by today as part of our Meet the Candidate series to talk about his campaign and take your questions, and we do invite you to give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. It seems like virtually all the candidates have some kind of some position on the prescription drug issue. It gets confusing for people. In a nutshell, what are you proposing to do about that?
I'm proposing two things primarily. One is a Medicare cover prescription medicines for the elderly, starting with complete coverage for those who are most indigent and for those who have the highest percentage of their income going to prescription medicine costs, and then prorated at higher levels of income or lower percentage of dependency. And then I'm also for the federal government through the Healthcare Finance Administration or some other entity directly negotiating with the pharmaceutical industry reductions in the prices that are charged for these medicines for all of our citizens, seniors and everyone else in the society, which is what governments in other countries are doing successfully. It's also what the HMOs and the businesses which self-insure are doing on a regular practice, negotiating reductions of 25 to 50% in the cost of these medicines for their members and for their employees. So I'm mystified as to why those who say that we ought to run government more like a business, and there's merit to that assertion, would object to the federal government negotiating price reductions in these drugs, which the industry itself admits most, if not their entire profits come out of the United States, because there is no restriction or negotiation on behalf of large segments of our population.
Mm-hmm. Governor Bush has suggested that his prescription drug plan would focus almost exclusively on low-income seniors, at least initially. Is your plan similar to that then, or?
Mine's similar, and it corresponds with Vice President Gore's. It's similar in that the highest percentage and amount of payments would be for the most indigent of seniors. But I think Governor Bush, the main difference really is that he is beyond a very low income base. I think about $12,500 for a senior. Above that, he's for subsidizing the insurance policies that seniors would purchase for the cost of these medicines, which even the insurance industry is not very enthusiastic about doing, because the costs are so uncertain, and it does nothing to limit the price increases. And so it's kind of surprising as a fiscal conservative that he and Senator Graham's is much along the same lines would just provide taxpayer subsidies for policies that are going to have to go higher and higher, because there's no attempt to limit the price increases that the pharmaceutical industry is charging.
You have taken a fair amount of criticism for your proposal to require all employers to offer health insurance, and the charge basically being that it would bankrupt a lot of small businesses. Any second thoughts about that proposal? Is there any other approach that you could see would be a reasonable one to try to make sure more people are covered?
I'm wide open to any better proposal. I want us to cover every individual in this country for their health care. I think that's an essential need, and I think it's shameful that we are the only industrialized nation in the world that does not provide health care for all of its citizens. How we do that, through what unique system, taking advantage of our industriousness, of our private sector, of our medical industry, I think is, you know, subject to discussion. And if someone has a better approach than one I proposed, I'd welcome it. I understand that businesses don't want to add in another cost factor. On the other hand, they also oppose any alternatives, the so-called single payer, which would have the government essentially act as the self-insurer for the entire country, and would provide then coverage paid outside of places of employment, is something that the business community by and large strongly opposes. So the question is, if not employer mandate, if not single payer, then what is the alternative other than having 43 million Americans who are out of who have no health insurance, 80% of whom are members of families where one or more adults work full time? So you have this anomaly that if you're on welfare, or if you're in prison in this country, you have your health care paid for by the government. If you're working full-time, you don't, and increasing numbers of cases. And if we want to avoid the burden on small businesses, we could at least start with the third of the working Americans who work for companies who employ more than 500 individuals who are not covered through health care policies through their workplace. Why not start with those, the Burger Kings, the Walmarts, the McDonald's? Those companies, I believe, certainly can afford to pay those costs. And if they don't pay them, then the rest of us pay either through higher premiums or higher taxes when the uninsured seek emergency health care.
Well, let's get some listeners involved here. Our guest this hour is DFL U.S. Senate candidate Mark Dayton. And if you have a question for Mr. Dayton, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Part of our Meet the Candidates series. These are always great opportunities to find out a little bit more about the candidates, where they stand on the issues. A nice one-to-one conversation. Matthew, your question, please.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm more of a Democratic independent voter, and one of the things that I voted for was Jesse Ventura. And one of the things he talked about was being a career politician. And I was wondering what Mark Dayton has been doing in the last few years, other than running for different races.
Well, Matthew, a fair question. I don't myself agree with the premise that having no prior experience it qualifies somebody to be a better office holder than someone else. I say if you got on a Northwest Airlines flight and the pilot got on board and said, well, this is going to be a different kind of flight, I've never flown an airplane before, I don't think you'd feel more reassured. So, if that's the basis of someone's determination, I totally respect that, but I don't myself agree with it. I have devoted my entire career to public service, the last 25 years to government service on behalf of the people of Minnesota, except when the people of Minnesota declined my services. So I plead guilty to having a long career in public office or seeking public office, and that's my commitment, and I think that's an asset. Others view it as a liability. I respectfully disagree.
Ernie, your question?
Yes. First of all, my comment is that I'm a retired person with excellent medical and other benefits of retirement, and it's something that was negotiated through government, and it's very good, and it's sound, and it's secure. And I really believe that Mark Dayton's position is very good. I also am covered by a single-payer plan, which the VA, the Veterans Administration, which gives me certain coverage and medical benefits. We have the models. They should work. Everyone should be covered. Thank you, Mark, for your work.
Well, thank you, Ernie. Thank you very much. And your point's very well taken. And we have so-called single-payer systems, as you say, where people have broad choices in terms of the doctors and the care and the like. And as I say, I'm open to whatever suggestion gets everybody covered.
I have to ask you about the surplus. So much of the conversation, not only in the Senate race, presidential race, congressional races, everybody's talking about what to do with all the projected surplus money that Washington is collecting. Yet now some independent analysts have come out and said, gee, there just may not be that much of a surplus. Instead of estimates of $2 trillion plus, I saw one estimate that it may be as small a surplus as, what, $350 million, which is quite a change. Another one was saying, well, it's probably more like $700 million. But at any rate, Can the nation, in your mind, really afford any substantial increases in spending or any tax cuts to speak of, given the uncertainty of the financial situation?
Well, as Yogi Berra once said, Gary, it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. And all we can do is work on the best analysis, best assumptions that are presently available, and know that those will certainly change over time, maybe for the better, maybe for the worse. I mean, just to prove your point, in 1993, the Congressional Budget Office projected for this year a deficit of over $400 billion. Now it's projecting a surplus of about $300 billion. So there's a swing of $700 billion in the course of 7 years, which is probably the best analysis of assumptions that could have been made at that point in time. So it underscores how wide these fluctuations can be. Certainly for the state of Minnesota, we've seen that. The federal level, even more so. Having said that, I think the Congressional Budget Office's current projections are the ones that we ought to work with from a standpoint of policy and begin to implement those proposals and then make adjustments accordingly. And right now they're proposing or projecting a non-dedicated surplus of $1.8 trillion over the next 10 years. And I think we do need to decide as a nation how we're going to allocate that. My own approach would be to emphasize tax cuts by 2-to-1 over spending increases. I'd increase spending for healthcare, for education, for Head Start, and for loan forgiveness program for post-secondary education. But I would provide tax cuts targeted toward middle-income individuals and working families, which would include making health insurance costs, premiums, fully tax-deductible for employees as well as employers, doubling the child tax credit from its present $500 to $1,000 per child, expanding the daycare tax credit to 50% of those costs for, and also expand both the child care and the child tax credit to include people who are caring for elderly parents or other members of their family, because I think more and more people are assuming those costs and want to keep their parents out of nursing homes or out of other situations. So it's actually very cost effective, but most importantly, it's just a basic humanity to encourage and support that. And then finally, making the costs of college tuition tax deductible for students or their parents. So, and then the balance of 64% of the remaining would be for debt reduction. And I think that's where we have a protection, because if these forecasts start to change and are not as rosy as they are, then we can cut back. We're not going to be in a situation where we have to turn right around and reverse those tax cuts.
But we would not make any progress then on actually paying down the national debt.
Well, that's, of course, the opportunity that hopefully we can see is why it's so important that the economy hopefully stay moving in the track that it is, because between the non-dedicated surplus, by my account here, about $1 trillion over the 10 years, and then the Social Security surplus, which would essentially also be used, you'd have about $3 trillion to use for those through those two accounts. And we have a federal debt right now publicly owed about $5.8 trillion, so we wouldn't eliminate it, but we'd certainly make a good dent in it. And I think that's crucial before the baby boom generation starts retiring the year 2014, to try to reduce the over $200 billion a year we're paying now on interest on the federal debt.
Therese, your question for Mark Dayton, please.
Hi, Mr. Dayton.
How are you, Therese?
I'm doing good. I typically would consider myself a Democrat, but one thing that's starting to bother me is it seems like it's increasingly common that people who get elected to higher office are people of substantial means. And I would like you to, I guess, address my question of why should I vote for you if it's my perception that if you get elected, you're basically buying your seat in office. And also, what's your position on campaign finance reform? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Fair questions, Therese. Well, at the cost of this campaign, I'm not going to be a senator of substantial means by the time it's over. And I say that partially facetiously, but not entirely so. I mean, I am very, very fortunate in being able to finance most of my campaign itself. But I'm certainly not any kind of advantage over the incumbent senator, who has both his own campaign receipts that, as of the last report, exceeded my own. His was $5.8 million for the campaign cycle. Mine was $5.2 million. and who now is using the Republican National Committee, Republican Senate Campaign Committee's soft money to pay for ads that are running attacking me. I've said I will not accept any money from the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee or the National Committee for my campaign or on my behalf to keep that kind of soft money out of Minnesota, at least on my account. And as I understand it, and haven't seen the results today, but it was reported last week that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as a conduit for the pharmaceutical industry, had bought $2 million of paid television advertising time in Minnesota during these remaining 4 weeks of the campaign to, we'll see, in other states they've been attacking Democratic Senate candidates and even incumbents who are favoring, as I do, reducing the prices and the profits of prescription medicines. So if you look at what I'm up against financially, I would say that I'm outmatched and will be in the aggregate outspent by the Senator Graham's committee and the other committees that he has working on his behalf. Having said all that, should we have campaign finance reform in this country? Absolutely yes. And I would vote for the McCain-Feingold bill that would eliminate soft money, that would put restrictions back on total campaign finance and the like. I can't advocate or vote for that unless I'm elected in the Senate, but I think as a citizen of this democracy, I think I'm concerned, and I think we should all be concerned about the cost of these campaigns and the sources of money which usually are funding them.
Would that bill affect your situation at all? I would think you would still, as a private individual, be able to spend whatever you'd want on your own campaign, but it would effectively limit, in this case, Senator Graham's ability to get support in the form of soft money.
Well, Gary, you're right. I mean, there are First Amendment issues in terms of self-financing, which the Supreme Court has ruled upon back in the 1970s. Maybe they could be persuaded to revisit that issue. I don't know that it would so much restrict the senator or anyone else's ability to raise the soft money. It would just eliminate this distinction between the soft money and the so-called hard money and would set contributions limits and the like that would apply across the board. But your point's well taken, and it leads me to my long answer, the short answer being supporting McCain-Feingold. What I will propose and introduce legislation in January if I'm elected is to set up a commission appointed by the president, by the majority and minority leaders of the House, the Senate, third parties, League of Women Voters, Common Cause, a whole spectrum of basically the most seasoned and experienced and hopefully wise members of our society. Walter Mondale comes to mind. And I would give this commission of, say, 50 members, none of whom would be in public office today, a mandate to come back in a year with a series of reforms that would achieve one purpose, would best serve the future of this democracy and all of its citizens. And then the Congress would vote that up or down. There would be no amendments. The president would sign it, hopefully, or veto it, because everybody would find something to dislike about it. And then hopefully this group, without a vested self-interest in the outcome, could come back and address all these spectrum of issues, including people like myself who have the advantage of being able to self-finance.
DFL U.S. Senate candidate Mark Dayton is our guest this hour, part of our Meet the Candidates series here on Midday. And again, if you have a question for Mr. Dayton, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828, and we'll get to more of your calls here in just a couple minutes.
Programming on NPR is supported by the Brooklyn Park Economic Development Authority, celebrating the Highway 610 opening, providing commercial and industrial opportunities as big as your imagination. Online at www.brooklynpark.org.
By the way, if you just moved to the area or recently discovered Minnesota Public Radio, we invite you to become a part of the NPR family by becoming a member. Members are a community of active listeners who voluntarily support the service they listen to. News headlines now. Here's Stephen John. Stephen?
Good morning, Gary. Yugoslavia's old regime is crumbling. The country's prime minister has stepped down while the legislature in the largest republic has resigned. Both were strong supporters of ousted strongman Slobodan Milosevic. The exchange of gunfire continues between Jews and Arabs, this just hours before Israel's deadline to the Palestinians to stop it or face action. There's been a mysterious twist in the Lockerbie bombing trial. Prosecutors at the special court in the Netherlands sought an unexpected adjournment today to look into what they call new evidence of considerable sensitivity. The judges agreed to hear four witnesses tomorrow and then postpone hearings until October 17th. Two Libyans are on trial for allegedly planting a bomb on Pan Am Flight 103, which blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. NASA will try again tomorrow to start the 100th shuttle flight. It's too windy at the launch site today to prepare for the liftoff. The flight is already 4 days late because of mechanical problems. Two Americans and a Swede will share this year's Nobel Prize for Medicine. They get a total of $915,000 for discoveries about how messages are transmitted between brain cells. Their work is being used in treating Parkinson's disease and depression. Catherine Cook Levine of Apple Valley High School is Minnesota's Teacher of the Year for 2000. Cook Levine has taught chemistry and science at Apple Valley since it opened in 1976. She was selected from 98 finalists and will represent Minnesota in the national competition. The wife of former Minnesota Governor Harold Stassen has died. Esther Stassen was 94 when she passed away at her home in Bloomington on Saturday. Esther and Harold Stassen were married for 70 years. Her funeral is scheduled for Wednesday at the Riverview Baptist Church in West St. Paul. The forecast calling for mostly sunny conditions. It will be a bit warmer statewide, highs in the mid-50s to lower 60s. For the Twin Cities, right around 60 degrees for the daytime high. Bemidji has 46 this hour, 47 at International Falls, while it's 52 in Marshall, 45 degrees in the Twin Cities. And that's a news update. Gary?
All right. Thank you, Stephen. It's about 27 minutes now before noon. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio, and our guest this hour is DFL U.S. Senate candidate Mark Dayton, who's come by today as part of our continuing Meet the Candidate series as we get ready for the November 7th election. Mr. Dayton is here to talk about his campaign and his stand on the issues. Don't call us right now with your question. We'd love to get your question on the air, but if you call now, you'll just get frustrated. So let us get a few of the lines cleared here and then give us a call. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Senate takes a primary role in foreign affairs. What in the world should the U.S. if anything, about the situation in the Middle East?
Well, just keep persisting, keeping the lines of communication open. I mean, you know, that has been a flashpoint for as long as I've been alive, and if you go back in history for thousands of years preceding, and so to think that we're going to solve those problems overnight or even in a year or an administration. I think it's a matter of you either getting things a little better or you're getting them a little worse. And so I think President Clinton, as his predecessors have done, who have emphasized that kind of diplomacy, bringing the participants, the leaders to Camp David, whatever, dealing with the enormous pressures and conflicts of people who are packed in incredibly close together and covet the same land for religious and historical purposes. I mean, it's about as intractable a situation as you could imagine anywhere in the world, and all the more reason just to try to keep as much as possible people at peace.
We had indicated, the U.S. had indicated, that it would lift sanctions against Yugoslavia when Slobodan Milosevic was removed from power. But another proviso of that was that he would be turned over for prosecution under the war crimes charges that he faces. He has apparently been removed from power, but apparently will not be extradited to face the charges. Should we lift the sanctions nevertheless?
It's my understanding that the Defense Secretary, William Cohen, called for the lifting of the sanctions against the country and its people while keeping the sanctions imposed on Mr. Milosevic and also keeping the pressure on to bring him to international justice, and I think that's the right approach.
Is there any circumstance that we should be using sanctions to try to influence other nations' policies, thinking Iraq, for example, and there have been limits on China trade in the past. There are the sanctions against Yugoslavia. Is that a good approach to foreign policy?
Well, I started as a strong believer in former President Jimmy Carter's statement that human rights should be a cornerstone of American foreign policy. The practice of that in practical terms has proven, from my experience, to be a lot more problematic than that laudable goal. So I think it's a matter of looking at each situation on a case-by-case basis. I think that the nature of a horrendously repressive regime in Iraq has justified the sanctions. The threat of nuclear armament there and chemical warfare production, I think, has been justified. On the other hand, you reach a point where you wonder if it's doing more harm to the citizens and humanitarian terms, medical and food in particular, than you're hurting the established leadership. Cuba is another example where I think the trade should be normalized, and except for military technology and weaponry, I think we should resume normal trading relations with Cuba. It's been something now that we've resumed relations with Vietnam and other countries in Southeast Asia. We certainly, I think, as a matter of history, then should be ready to resume relations with Cuba and try to both improve the standards of living of the citizens in that country, as well as encourage the democracy, which is more and more should be our objective everywhere.
So going forward, could we say that you're open to the idea, but maybe not as keen on it as you would have been a few years ago?
Well, again, I think we need to look at it on a case-by-case basis, and if the president, whoever that person is, were to propose economic sanctions as part of a foreign policy, I would be inclined to support the president of either party, because I think that's primary responsibility for the conduct of foreign policy. But I'd sure want to ask the questions and understand what the expected results are going to be. And I think recognize from the basis of these experiences that if we're not going to get some substantial results in the first couple of years, that we're probably just going to get into a protracted kind of situation where it's going to be less and less effective. And at that point, I think then we do need to reevaluate.
Kyle, your question for Mark Dayton?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. This is in reference to education, and both presidential candidates are advocating accountability for the schools and the school districts. My question is, why hasn't anyone taken a look at the actual university systems that teaches the teachers and gives them the tool to teach? We're always questioning the credibility of the teachers. Could you answer my question, and I'll take it on the air. Thanks.
Thank you, Kyle. Well, I think your point's well taken, although in Minnesota I think we do have both good teacher training programs and good standards of accreditation of teachers. And the main challenge we face, I believe, in Minnesota and elsewhere is providing sufficient resources for our public schools and our public school teachers to help them succeed, because having been in now over 150 public schools around the state in the last couple of years and several hundred classrooms, I taught school in New York City in 1969 to 71, and the job of public school teachers in Minnesota is tougher than when I had 30 years ago in New York, because of the whole spectrum of kids from all different nationalities, from different languages, cultures, kids with special needs. I mean, just the spectrum of what teachers are trying to cope with and reach is just phenomenal. So I think that the quality of teachers is much less a concern to me in Minnesota than it is the lack of resources and support for them to succeed.
If it's often said that, if in this case the federal government provides money in one form or another for education, well, strings go along with that. If the federal government does in fact expand its support for education, and it finds out that kids are still going to school in schools where the test results are poor and they don't seem to be learning, what should the federal government do about that?
Well, very good point, Gary. And the federal government, unfortunately, is guilty of applying strings even without the money. And I think the federal government is guilty of having far too many prescriptions and requirements and reporting that overlap with local government, state government, and across the board. I mean, I think that we have a national epidemic of this multiplication of the requirements and the like. So I would say that the federal funding for public education should be increased. I've focused on special education at the K-12 level, because when the federal government passed those mandates back in the 1970s, it said that it promised that it would pay for 40% of the cost of special education, and right now in Minnesota it's 9%, 12% nationwide. So if we were to meet that promise, which I think is important in its own right, we'd add $250 million a year in additional funding for Minnesota schools that would go right into the schools, right into the classrooms, and benefit not only kids with special needs, but all the kids who, because now dollars are being diverted from regular programs to make up the gap in special education funding. So I would start with that, and I would reduce the mandates even while increasing the funding, because, again, talking with special ed teachers around the state, more and more reporting requirements require them to spend more and more time away from their kids, and is literally driving qualified teachers out of the profession, which is just tragic. So I would say across the board, in fact, I have a bill that I'm going to propose again next year if I have the chance, that would require every federal agency to come back in 3 years having reduced by two-thirds the number of its regulations, reporting requirements, pages of documents. I mean, I just think we're super saturated with this stuff. And again, I think there ought to be an agreement among levels of government who's going to be the primary authority in each area. And I would say in terms of public education, it ought to be the local school boards.
Should the federal government set standards that all school districts are expected to meet?
You know, it's just very difficult to make nationwide proscriptions on something like standards, because I think we've seen in the state of Minnesota enough difficulty trying to get consensus on a statewide set of standards. I come to this office that I'm seeking with, you know, a background of working with local governments as state auditor, serving in head of three different state agencies over three decades. I have a lot of respect and confidence in the ability of certainly Minnesota local government, state government agencies to make good decisions and to carry them out. The people can hold them accountable. From a post-audit standpoint, the federal government or anyone else could come in and make sure dollars are being spent legally and properly. But to be dictating the outcome in a country as diverse as this one, I think has caused as much difficulty or more problems than it's solved. And so I'd say let's back off the federal proscriptions, except for some broad definition of parameters of how money ought to be used, and then rely on state and local government. Another case in point would be the recently Minnesota, now 39 states, are going to have to return money that was provided by Congress for child health services. Well, we still have 11 million children in this country who have no health insurance, but the states weren't able to match up their programs with these requirements of the federal government. So what purpose was served by having this money out there for the last 3 years, not spent, not being able to be used for its broad purpose, intended purpose, and now it's going to be returned to the federal government? And we're tying good people, service providers, public sector and private sector, up in knots, and senselessly, I believe.
Rick, your question?
Hi. Actually, now that Mark's talking about the issues, I hesitate to bring this up, but I wonder if you feel pressured to do any negative or attack advertising, and from your people, your campaign managers and ad people, et cetera. And do you worry that this could end up being a turning point in the election, be effective against you? And last, do you think that I heard an expert last week say that he saw an ad of yours that was negative, although I haven't seen it. But I was wondering if you could comment on those things.
Well, underscore the last point. I mean, I think that impressions are subjective. So what one person views one way, somebody else might view differently. I'm getting more advice to do everything around the spectrum. But my own conviction at this point is that I've been successful as I have so far because I focused on the issues and have run a positive issue-oriented campaign. I believe that the differences between Senator Graham's and myself on the issues that people care about benefit me. That's why I think the polls have been what they have been. So my intent is to keep the focus of my campaign on the issues and what I stand for, and to contrast them with the positions that Senator Graham's has taken, which I consider to be is called, you know, comparison advertising, or the debates are certainly great opportunities for people to hear us take our different positions and decide accordingly. So I wouldn't consider it to be negative advertising or campaigning if Senator Graham's wants to distinguish his positions from mine on issues, as long as he's presenting my positions with reasonable accuracy, and nor am I doing the same. I think that's what educates voters. I think to make personal attacks, to question the character, the integrity, the motives of somebody, I think is territory that I'd rather not get into, and I don't think that's what voters want. I've actually had a lot of people say to me, keep it positive, we appreciate you're doing that, and so I think ultimately if the voters of Minnesota on November 7th make that one of their criteria, I think we've got a chance to reaffirm that we in Minnesota have a higher standard for our campaigns than a lot of other parts of the country.
Will you stick to that if the polls you know, a week before Election Day show that Senator Graham's has surged ahead?
Well, again, I'd evaluate why he's done so, and I, you know, I believe that this election will be decided on the issues. So if I'm I would think if that occurs, I would have to look more at my own mistakes, failing, shortcomings than I would at trying to find a different course of action. I think anything that's done almost from this point forward that's in that realm smacks of the kind of desperation, which I think, again, will be seen for what it is. And ultimately, people, you know, as you pointed out at the beginning, Gary, I've run my races and lost and won. You know, in a democracy, the people decide. I mean, in a democracy, the people get to evaluate what I would do on their behalf and what Senator Grams would do on their behalf and what Mr. Gibson would do on their behalf, and then should make their own decisions and their own self-interests. And if the majority of people in this state want to go in a different direction from what I'm proposing, then they'd be better served by someone else, and I accept that.
Jim, your question?
Hi, good morning. I often hear in national politics as well as state politics the terms middle class and rich and working class. I'm assuming a person who makes $15,000 a year as well as a man who makes $150,000 a year would both consider themselves working class. But could Mark please comment on how he defines middle class and how he defines rich?
Well, I've said somewhat facetiously, Jim, in a couple of the debates that rich is what I was before my campaign started, middle class or lower middle class may be where I'll end up. But to take your question more seriously, I would say that the poverty level as defined for a family of four now is about $19,300. So I define the beginning range of middle class to be about $25,000 and the upper level of middle class to be about $90,000. And I don't think there's any hard or fast line either of those. And I also think middle class are people who essentially work every day in order to earn their income, as opposed to people who in the upper class who increasingly have investments, non-earned income that benefits or supplements their earned salaries.
Back to those budget projections again that we talked about a little bit earlier. The Congressional Budget Office last week said that things really do look pretty good for the next 10 years or so. Should be ample amounts of money coming in, but they say, the CBO says, after that, big, big problems with Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that costs are going to explode, and what's needed here is a major restructuring. Now, in terms of Social Security anyway, you've primarily talked about maybe working around the margins a little bit, that the Social Security system will be just fine without the kind of significant change that Senator Grams has talked about.
Well, in politics, as in medicine, the first law is to do no harm. And Senator Graham's proposal, which would allow workers to divert up to 80% of their FICA taxes, employer and employee, into this from the Social Security Trust Fund, would, by his own reckoning, cause a massive hemorrhaging of funds, and would, well, that's his own legislation requires the president to sell within 120 days of enactment $268 billion worth of federal assets just to pay for to make up for the expected losses. So I think that's the most catastrophic kind of policy in terms of impacting and jeopardizing Social Security that anyone's proposed. Beyond that, I don't, you know, Social Security is a current account system. It's not a pension fund as we define private and a lot of the public sector funds, where you have dollars that are being invested to generate returns for those retirees. Social Security is the dollars that are paid in today are paid out literally tomorrow to present retirees and other beneficiaries. And beyond the projections that are going to the next 15, 20 years, it's going to depend so much on the course of the United States economy. The Social Security trustees have projected that if what's called their mid-range forecast, which is actually conservative, even pessimistic view of economic growth in this country, it calls for a real GDP increase of 1.7% annually. That's almost half of what it has been over the last 30 or so years. The Social Security Trust Fund will start to run short of money in the year 2037, Medicare in the year 2025. Those are certainly not reasons for complacency, but on the other hand, it is certainly not a system that is in any imminent danger. Conversely, if the Social Security trustees project that if the economy grows at the 3.0% rate over the next 30 to 50 years that it has over the last 30 years, that in the year 2037, rather than having a zero balance, it would have a surplus of $50 trillion. We'd be talking about how to expand Social Security benefits and the like. So the bottom line is everything, whether it's Social Security, whether it's private investments, the like, depends on the health of the U.S. economy. If the economy turns bad and lasts for any extended period of time, yes, all of the government support programs will be in jeopardy. However, the stock market will be in worse shape because the stock market's volatility always historically has exceeded the swing in the revenue, public revenues and the general GDP and the like. So you're talking about, you have to make these comparisons apples to apples and oranges to oranges. If we're going to talk about the optimistic scenario, which is what the privatizers use to support their projections on what people will gain investing privately, then you have to use those same optimistic assumptions for what the returns will be on Social Security at that time. If you're going to say that Social Security is going to run short of money based on a more pessimistic set of assumptions, then you've got to apply those same economic assumptions to the outcome on the private investment side, and you'll see then that people are going to come out worse.
Not a lot of time left, but let's get one more caller on here quickly. Let's see. Why don't we go to Doris, your question, quick one? Doris, you're on the air.
Is this are you calling for Doris?
Yes.
Yes, I'm calling from Hibbing. And every year up at Cook, for many years, they've had Cook Days once a year in the summer. They have a parade and all kinds of things going. And my mother and I, my sister, we always took my mother up there because originally...
Okay, very, very briefly here, Doris. We're just about out of time.
Well, Mr. Dayton was up there campaigning. It had to be in the early 80s. And he came to my mother three different times and talked with her, held her hands, put his arm around her shoulder. And when he left, my mother said, "Don't you girls forget to vote for Mr. Dayton." She said, "He's just a wonderful man, and he's very concerned about the older people." And I thought that was so nice of him, and I can still see him.
Okay.
He's a wonderful man.
Well, thank you, Doris.
And I know he'll make it.
Thank you very much.
Most of the issues that the candidates have been talking about have been things of concern, well, not exclusively, but primarily to older folks. Young people have been saying, "Boy, you guys aren't saying anything of concern to us." How do you get younger people involved or interested in this campaign?
It's a fair criticism, Gary. I think part of it is because the debates we've had post-primary have been Chamber of Commerce venues that Senator Grams has proposed, and he declined to participate in a debate last Saturday at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth. Now we have one this Saturday evening in Sunday evening. And we're appearing before the Minnesota Student Association in Breezy Point couple weekends thereafter. Governor Ventura, to his credit, has been really encouraging the youth vote, and he's hosting a debate this Thursday night at the University of Minnesota campus. At this point, Governor Ventura will be the moderator, and a number of us from all the different parties will be there. Senator Grams has not confirmed at this point. So if we can get into venues and in front of audiences where there are more concerns about the cost of college education, the debt the kids are having to incur, the fact that young adults are the highest percentage of people without health insurance in this society, then I think we'll be able to reach out to young people as we should.
One other caller wanted an email address for the Dayton campaign. Do you have that handy?
I have an email address. Put my glasses on here. I don't email myself, but it's markdaytonformnmn.com.
All right. Thanks so much for coming in today, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Gary. Good to see you again.
DFL Senate candidate, U.S. Senate candidate Mark Dayton joining us on this hour of midday, part of our Meet the Candidate series. And yes, indeed, we have another Senate debate coming up here on Minnesota Public Radio. It'll be Sunday from Duluth, the College of St. Scholastica. So make sure you join us for that. Senator Grams, by the way, will be joining us in our Meet the Candidate series here in the studio. He'll be in on Friday, so get your questions ready for Senator Grams. 5 minutes now before 12.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, it's the 9th of October, 2000. Today is the holiest day on the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, commemorating the day on which the Israelites received the second tablets of the law as a sign of forgiveness from God. It's Columbus Day today, the holiday, though it was not until the morning of October the 12th, 1492, that the lookout on the Pinta announced the first sight of land. Today is also observed by many people as Leif Erikson Day, commemorating the 1,000th anniversary of the Scandinavian discovery of the New World in the summer of the year 1000, when Leif Erikson was blown off course, making his voyage from Norway to the settlements in Greenland, and instead of landing on Greenland, he put ashore in Labrador. It was on this day in 1992, thousands of residents of the eastern United States watched a meteorite streak across the sky over several states before it landed in Peekskill, New York. It had been orbiting the sun for millions of years. This meteorite, it entered the Earth's atmosphere with a sonic boom and came down on the back end of a 1980 Chevy Malibu, totaling the car. It's the birthday of Jill Kerr Conway in Hilston, New South Wales, Australia, 1934. Historian, she became the first woman to become president of Smith College. That was in 1975. And wrote a memoir, The Road from Kooraan, a narrative of growing up on an isolated sheep farm in New South Wales. In the annals of merchandising, it's the anniversary of the first supermarket. 1917, Clarence Sanders of Memphis received a patent for a self-service food store. It was the first Piggly Wiggly store in Memphis. It gave shoppers shopping baskets and allowed them to shop for themselves. It's also the anniversary of the first mail-order business. Aaron Montgomery Ward went into business with the delivery of the first Montgomery Ward catalog on this day in 1872. It's the birthday of the writer and historian Bruce Catton in Petoskey, Michigan, 1899, who produced a monumental trilogy on the history of the Civil War, Mr. Lincoln's Army, Glory Road, and A Stillness at Appomattox. And it was on this date in 1781, French and American troops at Yorktown, Virginia, under the command of General George Washington, fired the first shots of what would be the last major battle of the American Revolution, the Battle of Yorktown. It ended 10 days later, on October the 19th, with the surrender of the British commander, General George Cornwallis. Here's a poem for today by David Huddle, Things I Know, Things I Don't. Virginia in early October is a soft countryside, color not yet in the trees, but the leaves green going pale, the sunlight's angle sharp, the birds about to move. Those cool mornings you catch a whiff of wood smoke, evenings you feel a chill ring the air like a high, soft-blown flute note. That season of my father's death was not wrong, not wrong at all. If he had been well that day, he might have taken a walk with mother, one of their short strolls. Early that morning there had been heavy fog that was all gone by 9. He'd have liked how that